Philosophers sometimes treat the phrase intention in action as a technical term. But a concept that's expressible in those words comes easily to common sense. What I want to consider is an understanding of intention in action that we can have just by being familiar with relevant regions of our ordinary language. The most obvious way to begin isolating intention in action is to distinguish it from intention for the future. An intention in action would need to be contemporaneous with the action it's in. The contrast here is with a prior intention, an intention to do such and such at some future time. A prior intention predates the action that is its execution, if indeed there is any such action, as there will not be if the agent is prevented or changes her mind or forgets her intention. Not all intentional action is execution of what was a prior intention. One can just set to and act. But when acting intentionally is executing what was a prior intention, how does the prior intention relate to the intention in action that we implicitly acknowledge when we say the action is intentional? On John Searle's account, intentions in action are new items that a prior intention starts to generate when the time to execute it comes. Prior intentions and intentions in action, on this account, are different even apart from the difference in their temporal relation to stretches of activity. A prior intention has as its object an action, doing such and such at some future time. But an intention in action, generated by the prior intention at its due time, has as its object not the action the agent is embarking on at that time, but a component of it. Consider, for instance, and I'll stay with this instance pretty much throughout, consider, for instance, an intention harbored by someone standing on a curb, the intention to cross the street when the light turns green. When she sees the light turn green, that intention, on Searle's account, starts to generate intentions in action. The prior intention has as its object crossing the street, but the intentions in action have as their objects the limb movements that need to happen if the person is to do that. As those limb movements begin, the person begins crossing the street. If all goes well, she gets to the other side, thereby completing an action of crossing the street. The action, on Searle's account, is a causally structured complex. Its components are, first, the intentions in action that the prior intention began to generate when the agent saw the light turn green, and second, the limb movements on which the intentions in action are targeted, which the intentions in action will have caused if the agent gets to the other side. Now, I think it's clear that this is a bit of philosophical theory. It's not a spelling out of ways we learn to think just by learning to talk about acting intentionally. And I doubt that Searle would dispute that. He's right here and he could dispute it. Searle would say, I think, that there are philosophical purposes for which his theory is needed. I'm not going to try to assess that claim directly. I've brought in Searle's theory only as a helpful foil to bring into relief a different answer to the question how intentions in action are related to intentions for the future. I would claim that the different answer, the one I'm about to give, is more natural. And if that's right, it can't be irrelevant to the philosophical purposes for which Searle thinks we need his theory. But I'm not going to address that for its own sake. On this different account, the account that I want to contrast with Searle's theory, when one sees the light turn green and starts crossing the street, It's not that an intention for the future starts to generate new items, intentions in action as Searle conceives them. Rather, what was an intention for the future becomes an intention in action. When one starts to do something that one had a prior intention to do, say, crossing the street, one's intention, now in action, is still targeted on doing that, crossing the street, not on limb movements that might be seen as components in doing that. The intention in action differs from the prior intention it used to be in that the time specified in spelling out what it was an intention to do has come. When its time comes, it takes its new shape as an intention in action, provided the agent knows the time has come, isn't prevented from acting, and doesn't change her mind when the moment for acting arrives. What were prior intentions become intentions in action on this picture through the operation of an ability to keep track of time? My street crossing case involves a very simple instance of that ability, the ability to keep track of time. A future time for acting is determined in that case, determined in thought, as the time at which a recognizable thing is going to happen, the time at which the light is going to turn green. When that recognizable thing happens, the subject recognizes that the time has come, and the intention becomes an intention in action. Of course, the ability to keep track of time has more sophisticated forms also. And of course, the ability's relevance to a subject's psychological history isn't restricted to the persistence through time of intentions. The ability to keep track of time is operative whenever one keeps hold of time-specific thoughts as time passes. For instance, one can retain for a while a bit of knowledge that one could express when one acquired it by saying, "The light is turning green." One needs to express that knowledge differently later, maybe by saying, "The light turned green a while ago." It's the same bit of knowledge, persisting through the passage of time, that needs to be expressed in those different ways. Just so, I'm urging, it's the same intention, persisting through the passage of time, that alters from being an intention for the future to being an intention in action when its time comes, provided that it doesn't lapse through change of mind or forgetfulness, and provided that the agent knows its time has come and isn't prevented from acting. Now, objecting to Searle's conception of intentions in action, Brian O'Shaughnessy points out that at any moment while one is, say, intentionally crossing a street, one has an intention that's still directed at the future. At any time during the crossing, one intends to go on crossing from the point one has reached to the other side. O'Shaughnessy works with an example of swimming the English Channel, but the structure is the same, so I'll stay with crossing a street. An intention to go on crossing the street isn't an intention in action in Searle's sense. This intention has as its object a prospective action, going from the point one has reached to the other side of the street. But the intentions in action, in Searle's sense, that are supposed to be operative in intentionally going on crossing the street, would have as their objects the limb movements that need to happen if one is to do that. Items that are not themselves actions, but that Searle conceives as components of actions. In response to that objection from O'Shaughnessy, Searle acknowledges that after one has embarked on executing a prior intention, an intention for the future persists into the time of acting. There's an ever-shrinking residue of the original prior intention present throughout the time of acting as an intention whose object is still in the future. In my example, an intention whose content at any time is to go from the point one has reached to the other side. Searle writes, very suggestive phrase, of the remains of the prior intention. So the prior intention is still present, but increasingly less and less of it. But Searle distinguishes this shrinking residue of the prior intention from the intentions in action that bring about the limb movements required for executing it. When one realizes that the time determined for acting by the original prior intention has come, when one sees the light turn green in my example, the intention that was a prior intention starts to generate directly suitable intentions in action, and thereby indirectly to generate suitable limb movements. Thereafter, persisting in its increasingly residual form, its shrinking form, it goes on indirectly generating limb movements by directly generating intentions in action as one goes on crossing the street. And that picture presumably applies also to cases where there was no prior intention, where one just sets to and acts intentionally. Throughout an intentional street crossing, even if there was no prior intention, there must be an intention of the sort that where there was a prior intention, Searle conceives as a shrinking residue of it. That is, an intention directed at each moment towards a future action, going from the point one has reached to the other side. Searle's picture has to be that whether or not there was a prior intention, intentionally crossing a street involves a shrinking intention for the future that progressively discharges itself by generating intentions in action that in turn generate suitable limb movements. Now, contrast the alternative picture that I described. On that picture, when acting is executing a prior intention, an intention in action is what the prior intention becomes when the time it determines for acting arrives. When its time comes and the agent knows it, the intention, provided it's not thwarted and provided it doesn't lapse through change of mind or forgetfulness, takes on the new guise of an intention that has begun to express itself in action. And now the phenomenon that O'Shaughnessy points to, the directedness towards a diminishingly future stretch of action, falls straightforwardly into place. It's just what one would expect of a persisting intention that has become an intention in action in that way, and that continues to be operative throughout the acting in which it expresses itself. And similarly, with an intention that begins its career as an intention in action, rather than becoming an intention in action after a phase in which it's an intention for the future. To be explicit about the background to this phenomenon, we need more than the ability to keep track of time. That was enough for making sense of the alteration from a prior intention to an intention that has begun to be acted on. Now we need also the ability to know how one's action is progressing. Unless one can keep track of how far one has come, one can't intelligibly intend to go on from there to the other side of the street. But this is obviously not a gratuitous new requirement. The ability to keep track of the progress of one's action is a condition for being able to do things like intentionally crossing streets at all. O'Shaughnessy draws more distinctions than I'm envisaging. In O'Shaughnessy's view, there's an overarching intention of crossing the street, which may or may not have previously been an intention for the future, but which in either case persists in its entirety after one has begun crossing the street, though more and more of the street crossing that it's directed at recedes into the past as one goes on crossing. And there is, in addition, in O'Shaughnessy's view, a continuum of intentions for the future, one for any instant during the period in which one's crossing the street, directed at progressively less extensive completions of the crossing. O'Shaughnessy conceives these future directed intentions as caused by the overarching persisting intention of crossing the street, and so as distinct from it. With this continuum of future directed intentions, O'Shaughnessy is addressing the phenomenon that Searle aims to accommodate by envisaging a single shrinking intention, maybe a residue of what was a prior intention, intelligibly shifting in its future directed content as one makes progress in one's action, as one makes progress across the street. But O'Shaughnessy's conception of the overarching intention of crossing the street seems enough to accommodate that phenomenon. Unlike Searle's shrinking intention for the future, O'Shaughnessy's overarching intention stays, as it were, the same size. It has throughout the whole intended street crossing as its object. The extent of its directedness at the future shrinks, but shrinkage in its projected future is the same as expansion in how much achievement lies behind it. And as far as I can see, that picture, O'Shaughnessy's picture, of the persisting overarching intention leaves unmotivated O'Shaughnessy's idea that there is also a continuum of future-directed intentions, each directed at a different remainder of the street crossing, caused by the overarching intention, and hence distinct from it. The shifting future-directedness is just what's to be expected of the overarching intention itself, as it progressively finds expression in crossing the street. The multiple intentions that O'Shaughnessy invokes, with their orientation towards smaller and smaller continuations of what one's doing into the future, are just successive shapes taken by a persisting intention in action. The general form of this future directedness of intention in action is this: to do whatever's needed in order to finish doing what one's doing. What could be more obvious than that? In the street crossing example, that idea functions in a particularly simple way. At any time in the course of crossing the street, what one still needs to do is to go from the point one has reached to the other side of the street. But the same structure fits projects with more complicated shapes, such as baking a cake or building a house. In these cases, when we spell out what's required if one is to finish doing what one's doing, at a moment at which one is some way into doing it, we need to introduce things to do with more complex relations to what one has already done. Having beaten the eggs, one needs to fold in the flour, and so on until the cake is baked. But the idea of going on until one has finished doing what one is doing still fits for the content of the diminishingly future-directed intention that, on the picture I'm recommending, an intention in action is. Robert Brandon says intentions in action can be what intentions that used to be prior intentions become when their time comes. And that's just what I've been urging. But Brandom frames his account of intentions in action in terms of Wilfred Sellers's account of what Sellers calls volitions. And I want to take issue with that. This will bring out a feature of intentions in action that Brandom's treatment risks obscuring. Sellers introduces volitions as what intentions for the future become when their time comes. In a passage that Brandom quotes, Sellers describes how a thought expressible at a certain time by "I shall raise my hand in 10 minutes" persists in a subject who keeps track of time, needing to be expressed differently as time passes. "I shall raise my hand in 9 minutes. I shall raise my hand in 8 minutes, and so on until we get to, I shall raise my hand now, at which point the thought has become a volition, and the agent starts to raise her hand. This scenario involves a somewhat sophisticated variety of the ability to keep track of time, and there'd have to be a timekeeping device in play. But it would be in the spirit of Sellers's discussion to apply its materials to the example I've been using, in which keeping track of time takes a simpler form. So imagine a subject standing on a curb with an intention expressible by saying, I shall cross the street when the light turns green. When this subject sees the light turn green, the intention becomes a volition, expressible by saying, I shall cross the street now. A bit complicated, because you're watching the light, you have to time your saying of now to the moment when the light turns green. Sellers's official policy here is to give shall a technical use as a device for expressing intentions in general, not just intentions for the future. In the kind of progression that he describes, shall shifts from pulling its weight in expressing an intention for the future, I shall raise my hand in 10 minutes, to expressing a volition, as with the passage of time, the time specification shifts from in 10 minutes to now, or from when the light turns green to now in the example that I've added. But it's questionable whether Sellers's wording is a good fit for intentions in action in general. This may not be a problem for Sellers's account of volitions, but it is a problem for Brandom's claim that Sellers's account of volitions will do as an account of intentions in action. An utterance of now refers to the time at which it's made. In Sellers's scenario, the reference of now is determined by an indication, presumably from a timekeeping device, that 10 minutes have elapsed. Here it's particularly clear that the reference of now must be, notionally at least, instantaneous. That makes it appropriate that now should come at the end of Sellers's form of words, I shall raise my hand now, with the naturally future-pointing shall figuring in what leads up to it. Ideally, I would begin saying, I shall cross the street now, shifting to my example, while my street crossing is still in the future. And I would reach my utterance of now at the moment at which I step off the curb and begin crossing. But if that's right, then as soon as I'm actually crossing the street, the moment that would have to be meant by that use of now is past. So the Sellersian form, I shall cross the street now, doesn't naturally serve as a verbal expression for the intention that is in action when I'm crossing the street. It expresses an intention for what's still, until one gets to the end of saying it, the future. A future that starts as one finishes the utterance with the word now. Even raising one's hand, Sellers's example, takes time. It's more obvious of crossing a street, but takes a while to get your hand up. I suspect Sellers forgets that. At least he ignores it. The result is that he doesn't allow for a distinction between a moment at which one starts doing something and a time during which one is doing it. For actions that take time, I shall do such and such now is perhaps apt for expressing the onset of an intention in action, but it's not apt for expressing its continuing operation. Maybe an onset of an intention in action is all a Sellersian volition was ever meant to be in the case of actions that take time. But something goes missing if it's suggested that an instantaneous volition at the moment of starting to act is all the intending there needs to be when someone intentionally raises her hand or intentionally walks across a street, as if a momentary injection of willpower at the beginning would be enough to get the project completed. If doing such and such takes time, the intention that's involved in doing such and such intentionally needs to be in action throughout the time of acting, not just at the beginning. The appropriate verbal expression for an intention in action, staying with my example, is not, I shall cross the street now, but I am crossing the street. That's something truly sayable, at any rate in the interpretation that's needed here, only after one has begun crossing. And I remark in passing that Searle gets that right. It's not that the words, I am crossing the street, are guaranteed to express an intention, even assuming they're used correctly. I might say, I am crossing the street as I'm being swept along by a flood. If the words are to express an intention, they must express practical knowledge, in the sense that G.E. M. Anscombe appropriates from Aquinas. In saying, I am crossing the street, I must be expressing knowledge that's not derived from what's known, as it would be in the case in which I'm being swept along by a flood. There must be a dependency between the knowledge and what's known that goes in the opposite direction. If things go wrong in the exercise of the capacities that issue in this sort of knowledge, so that I'm not in fact doing what, taking myself to have knowledge of this sort, I take myself to be doing, the primary error is not in my thought about what I'm doing, as it would be if the knowledge were receptive rather than practical. The primary error is in what I'm doing. That concept, the concept of practical knowledge, is important and difficult. Much more needs to be said about it, but I'm going to have to leave it in the sketchy shape in which I've just introduced it. Brandom says intentions in action are unique in being able to be directed at particular actions. Going further in the same direction, George Wilson actually specifies intentions in action as intentions directed de re at particular actions. But it may be true of one that one is crossing a street, though one isn't going to cross the street. Perhaps halfway over, one's going to be knocked down by a bus. One's intention in action may be correctly specifiable by saying, I am crossing the street, even if one isn't going to make it to the other side. So there may never be a relevant particular action of the sort that figures in the specification of one's intention in action. There may be no action for it to be directed at de re. Reality comes to contain, as it were, a relevant particular action of the type describable as my crossing the street, only when it gets to be true to say, I have crossed the street. But at that point, the time for the relevant intention of crossing the street to be an intention in action is over. I say the relevant intention because, of course, I may have embarked on another intentional street crossing. When an intention of crossing a street is an intention in action, it has behind it, at any point, a stretch of action with the particularity that comes with completion, signaled by a truth, the truth of a claim in the perfect tense. One has moved to here, to put it in a way that requires imagining oneself engaged in the action. But an intention in action also looks forward to a stretch of action that may never emerge into reality as a particular achievement, moving from here to the other side. By the time there's a particular action of crossing the street, for a thought of crossing the street to be directed at, one has crossed the street, and it's too late for the thought to have the nature of an intention. So there's no coherent way to suppose that the actions that intentions are in, when they are intentions in action, are particular actions. It must be wrong to think directedness at particular actions is the distinctive mark of intentions in action. Now, I've framed the conception of the reality of particular actions that threatens the Brandom-Wilson doctrine in terms of a mode of thought to which tenses matter. Actions are a species of events, and I'm urging an asymmetry between things that have happened which I'm allowing as particulars, and things that are going to happen, or things that are happening, which I'm not allowing as particulars. Someone may want to object that from a tenseless perspective, there'd be no warrant for that asymmetry. Particular substances come into reality when they are, say, born or made. They depart from reality when they die or are destroyed. In contrast, it's natural to say that, like events of other sorts, particular actions, once they've acquired their particularity, have the kind of reality that's appropriate to events from then on. They become part of history, in a slightly peculiar but intelligible sense, in which history can include events that have been forgotten. But in spite of this contrast, an asymmetry that corresponds to the one I'm urging for events shows up for substances also, and I think it's instructive to think about this. Particular substances don't lose their particularity when they go out of existence. One can say of such a particular that it no longer exists. Whereas things in the category of substance that don't yet exist are not yet available to be referred to as particulars. Well, that may be an overblown way to put it, but something on those lines I think we have to accept. Thinking ourselves into a tenseless perspective can't require us to suppose that when we revert to the perspective of a thinker in time, we need to distinguish two different logical forms for an expression like, I am baking a cake. One in which a particular cake is in question, and one in which that's not so. Though at the time when one might say such a thing, one can't tell which of the two forms one's saying has. Suppose I'm baking a cake. Perhaps a God's eye view, from outside the temporal unfolding of events, has in its scope a cake that's going to result from my cake baking. It'll be a particular cake, certainly. After all, there's no other kind of cake, as Frege might have said. But it can't be that if that's so, then I am baking a cake, something intelligible only at a time-bound perspective, has a relational form amounting to there is a cake that I am baking, and if not, not. What one says when one says I am baking a cake isn't proved false if no cake results from one's activities. Consider, I was baking a cake, but I was interrupted and I never finished. And this independence of the statement's truth from a requirement that a cake be going to come into existence must characterize a form such as saying has, even if a cake is going to come into existence, as a result of the activities described by the person who says it. It can't be necessary to wait and see whether one's cake baking is going to be successful before one can know what logical form to assign to one's statement, I am baking a cake. It's true that after one has brought one's cake baking to a successful conclusion, one can point and say, this is the cake that I was baking. But we mustn't take that to supply the instance that made it true earlier to say, I am baking a cake, construed as equivalent to, there is a cake that I am baking. As if when the cake comes into existence, it turns out that one can follow up something amounting to, there is a cake that I am baking, after maybe a long interval, by saying, namely this one. Just so, at the time-bound perspective at which one might say, I am crossing the street, the logical form of what one's saying can't await a determination by what's going to happen. So that I am crossing the street relates me to a particular action of crossing the street if there's going to be one. That is, if I'm going to get to the other side, and if not, not. The logical form of I am crossing the street must be determinable from the time-bound perspective at which alone it so much as makes sense. And that requires us to say it doesn't relate me to a particular action, even if I am going to get across the street, so even if there is going to be a suitable particular action. While one's performing an action of a sort constituted by a terminus, like crossing a street, which isn't complete until one has reached the other side, one is engaging in various activities, maybe moving one's legs in a certain way, maybe walking simpliciter rather than walking from somewhere to somewhere. Walking from somewhere to somewhere is constituted by terminus. You have to have got to the somewhere for you to have done that. Activities, in the sense that I'm using that word in now, occupy time in a different way from actions. As soon as one is embarked on an activity, the activity is all there in a way that's indicated by the fact that one can attribute it with the use of the perfect tense. As soon as one is walking, one has walked. Of course, that doesn't imply that the current stretch of walking is over. Since the activity is all there at any moment, we can, if we like, conceive it as an object, a rays. And then it seems harmless to characterize a shape taken by one's intention in action at any time in one's progress across the street as the intention concerning one's current relevant activity that it contribute suitably to crossing the street. That's as close as we can get to the Brandom-Wilson doctrine. Intention in action can be seen as relating de re to relevant activity. But that's not to say that intention in action relates de re to the action it's in. As I said, O'Shaughnessy countenances, besides the overarching intention of crossing the street, a continuum of exclusively future-directed intentions, one for each moment in crossing. I suggested a unification. Instead of these distinct and multiple future-related intentions, focus on the diminishingly future-directed aspect of the persisting, overarching intention itself. Now, O'Shaughnessy also envisages yet another set of intentions, contemporaneous with their expression in action, that would be operative when someone is crossing a street. Intentions directed at moving one's limbs as the project requires. Intentions of this sort reflect motor skills, not just the ability to make the movements needed for the routine exercise of a skill such as walking, but sometimes a more finely tuned responsiveness to circumstances, as when one puts a foot down carefully to compensate for an unevenness in the surface. Here, we're closer to Searle's intentions in action than anything so far has brought us. But as O'Shaughnessy insists, these intentions are still distinct from intentions in action in Searle's sense. An intention in action in Searle's sense has as its object a limb's moving, thus and so, whereas an intention of this kind has as its object one's moving the limb, thus and so. Now, here too, I see no need to multiply intentions as O'Shaughnessy does. O'Shaughnessy conceives these detailed motor intentions as generated by the overarching intention, and so as distinct from it. But as far as I can see, we don't need to follow him in this. We can see these motor intentions, rather, as shapes taken by the overarching intention as it expresses itself. In the picture as we already have it, persisting intentions change their shape from being intentions purely for the future to being intentions in action as a subject keeps track of time. And once they've taken on the guise of intentions in action, they change to having less in prospect and more behind them of what they are intentions to do as an agent makes progress in a project. In the same unifying spirit, we can say that these same intentions, intentions to do things like crossing streets, change from one determinate short-term motor shape to another as they express themselves in acting. Motor skills are anyway obviously presupposed by the very idea of intentions to do things like crossing streets. But in making their role explicit, I've added a third item to the background against which the shifting career of a persisting intention is intelligible. I was already appealing to the ability to retain thoughts through the passage of time and to the ability to keep track of the progress of actions. The third item is the ability to gear one's movings of one's limbs to the circumstances in which one exercises one's motor skills. These are all things on which the changes of shape undergone by an intention to do something like crossing a street depend. Well, I've diverged from O'Shaughnessy in rejecting the multiplicity of intentions that figures in his picture. I've suggested that the overarching persisting intention to cross the street will do all the jobs that he envisages. I want to differ from O'Shaughnessy in another way as well. O'Shaughnessy doesn't allow the title, Intention in Action, to any of the intentions he countenances. He thinks there's something wrong with the very idea of an intention in action. I've been working with the thought that we might refuse to count as intentions in action the items that Searle applies that label to, intentions whose objects are that one's limbs should move in certain ways, but that we might apply the label to different candidates, in particular to the persisting overarching intentions that O'Shaughnessy himself acknowledges. But O'Shaughnessy would have no sympathy with that. O'Shaughnessy's skepticism about the very idea of intention in action is in the first instance directed against the way Searle uses the notion. This is all from O'Shaughnessy commenting on Searle's treatment of intention in Intentionality. With intentions in action, as Searle conceives them, it's not just that they're not prior to the actions they're said to be in. That wouldn't be objectionable by O'Shaughnessy's lights. Searle's intentions in action are supposed to be in the actions in another sense, besides that merely temporal one. They're supposed to be components of actions. And O'Shaughnessy finds it unintelligible that anything deserving to be conceived as an intention might, as he puts it, I quote, actually enter the precincts of the action itself. The implications of that are more general than hostility to Searle's idea that an intention might be in action by being a component of it. If we accept this prohibition on intentions entering the precincts of action, we have to suppose that the intention of crossing a street, to fix on the single item to which I've suggested we can reduce the multiplicity of contemporaneous intentions that O'Shaughnessy countenances, we have to suppose that the intention of crossing a street relates to someone's crossing the street only from outside. Compare perhaps how an intention that a tree should fall might relate to the tree's falling if the intention is realized in one's sawing completely through the trunk of the tree with the result that the tree falls. I don't want to defend Searle's idea that an intention might be in action by being a component of it. But I do want to resist any suggestion that the relation between intention and action is appropriately modeled on the relation between an intention operative in sawing through the trunk of a tree and the tree's falling, a case where, to echo O'Shaughnessy, the intention doesn't enter the precincts of the falling itself. That seems obviously correct in that case. I want to urge that the intention of crossing a street, conceived in the protean or shape-shifting way that I've been recommending, shouldn't be conceived as relating to one's crossing the street only from outside. And I'm going to spell this out by exploiting another region of O'Shaughnessy's own thinking, namely O'Shaughnessy's groundbreaking work on the will. There, O'Shaughnessy presents a dual aspect conception of physical or bodily action. Acting physically is exercising motor capacities, and exercising a motor capacity is, as such, a bodily phenomenon. But according to the dual aspect conception, it's also psychological, and not just in an isolable component, but through and through. So we have one phenomenon that is both totally physical and totally psychological. A psychological concept, expressible by the word willing, applies not to some supposed psychic initiating occurrence, but to the relevant bodily goings-on, those describable as a subject's exercising a motor capacity, in their entirety. Willing, in this sense, is not something that causally initiates bodily acting and perhaps supervises it from outside, it would be natural to say. Willing is in the acting, not in the sense that willing is part of an action, but in the sense that willing, the word, is a characterization of the acting itself, apt for capturing its psychological aspect. That's O'Shaughnessy's dual aspect conception of the will. Now, O'Shaughnessy is impressed by the thought that willing, conceived like that, belongs to animal life as such, whereas intending doesn't. Intending is not universal in animals. O'Shaughnessy marks the restriction by saying that intention can be attributed only to animals whose behavior is future-directed in a certain distinctive way. Consider a cat slinking along, belly to ground, with whiskers twitching, in a way that can be explained by saying that it's stalking a bird. That explanation implicitly invokes a projected future in which the bird has been caught. It's stalking a bird answers a version of the question, why, in terms of which Anscombe famously isolates intentional action. In fact, that example of the attribution of intention to animals other than human beings is Anscombe's own. So the thought is that the concept of intention doesn't have as broad a scope as the concept of willing in O'Shaughnessy's sense, even before we consider the special form in which the concept of intention applies to rational animals. O'Shaughnessy accommodates that by holding that intending is additional to the willing that is just acting under a description that brings out its psychological aspect. Intending, according to O'Shaughnessy, belongs to a higher region of the psychological. He puts this by saying intending is not just psychological, it's mental. Intending causally initiates willing, that is, acting, and supervises it from outside its precincts. Well, we certainly have to acknowledge that the idea of intending is different from the idea of willing, plain and simple. Willing, that is, as it's found in animals that don't have intention. But do we have to agree with O'Shaughnessy that intending is additional to willing? Why not conceive intention in action as a special form taken by willing in animals that are at least, as we might put it, proto-rational? That would allow us to go further than O'Shaughnessy does with the dual aspect conception of bodily action as both physical through and through and psychological through and through. If intention in action is a species of willing, then, like the willing plain and simple, to which O'Shaughnessy restricts the concept of willing, it can be in action, not in a Searle-like sense, that it's a component in actions, but in an O'Shaughnessy-like sense, that it just is acting, characterized in a way that captures a now more sophisticated psychological aspect that this kind of acting has. So dual aspect conception extended to intention. It may seem a problem for this proposal that willing, in O'Shaughnessy's sense, is nothing but acting, whereas in contrast, intending makes its appearance not only in the form of intention in action, but also, at least in rational animals, in the form of intention purely for the future. Intention purely for the future can't be just what willing is, that is, acting, characterized in a way that brings out its psychological aspect. But surely we might think intention in the course of being acted on should be just what intention purely for the future is, except that its time is present. But everything depends on the direction in which we take that equation. We might think it requires us to base a conception of intention in action on an independently intelligible conception of intention purely for the future. That would threaten the possibility of supposing that intention in action is a species of willing, that intention in action just is acting on the part of an animal that's at least proto-rational, but described so as to highlight its psychological aspect. But we do better to do things the other way around. We do better to center our conception of intention as such on intention in action and frame our conception of intention purely for the future in a way that suits how it's best to understand intention in action. Once intention purely for the future is on the scene, we're concerned with rational animals, and we can say an intention is the kind of thing that can be arrived at by practical reasoning, though intentions don't need to be arrived at like that. Practical reasoning can be for the future. I can reason about which bus to take tomorrow and conclude by forming an intention to take the one that leaves at 8:28. But that shouldn't dislodge us from holding that when practical reasoning is about what to do now, drawing the conclusion is acting, as Aristotle says. Intention for the here and now is, if you like, a kind of thought. But it's practical in the strong sense that assenting to such a thought just is beginning to act in a certain way. For instance, starting to cross a street. And continuing to assent, not revoking one's assent, just is going on acting. For instance, going on crossing the street. An intention for the future is by all means a thought of that same kind, apart from the time difference. But the way to accommodate that is not to distance intention for the here and now from acting, on the ground that intending purely for the future isn't acting, true enough, but to picture an intention purely for the future as a potential action biding its time. When its time comes, provided the agent knows its time has come and isn't prevented, and provided she doesn't change her mind or forget the intention, it will become an instance of willing, that is, acting. On these lines, we can sustain the extended version of the dual aspect conception. We can say intention in action is the form taken in intending animals by willing, conceived in an expanded version of O'Shaughnessy's way. Intention in action just is acting under a characterization that brings out its psychological aspect, a psychological aspect that's more sophisticated than the one captured by talk of willing, plain and simple. The picture of intention for the future as potential action biding its time is no more than an application, now in the context of the extended dual aspect conception, of the idea that intentions for the future become intentions in action when their time comes, provided the agent knows the time has come and isn't prevented and doesn't change her mind. According to the extended dual aspect conception, Talk of intention in action is just talk of acting intentionally, framed so as to emphasize its psychological aspect. Since there can be intentions for the future, acting intentionally can be, though it needn't be, the mature form of something that was already present before acting was underway. For a picture, we might say an intention for the future stands to the acting one engages in when one starts to execute it, or equivalently to the intention in action that it becomes at that point. Those were two specifications of the same thing. As a caterpillar stands to the butterfly that it metamorphoses into. My talk of shape-shifting intentions may have seemed metaphysically extravagant, but from the vantage point that I've reached now, I hope it should be clear that there's less to that talk than there may have seemed while I was engaging in it. One kind of shape-shifting, the shift from prior intention to intention in action, is what I'm now in a position to describe as the alteration from action in waiting to action in progress. Action in waiting is something whose essential nature is that in due course, failing prevention, change of mind, losing track of time, it matures into action in progress. For the rest, talk of a persisting intention that changes its shape as time passes is no more than a way of talking, surely harmlessly, of the unfolding of an action intentionally undertaken. Thank you for listening patiently.